Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ben Stroud about his story, Three Omens of Federico de Montefeltro, which appeared in issue 23 of The Common. Ben Stroud is the author of the story collection Byzantium, which won the 2013 Story Prize Spotlight Award and the Breadloaf Writers Conference Bakeless Prize for Fiction. His stories have been published in Harper's, Zoetrope, Virginia Quarterly Review, Oxford American, Vice, and One Story, among other places, and have been anthologized in the Pushcart Prize anthology New Stories from the South and the Best American Mystery Stories. He is currently Associate Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Toledo. Ben Stroud, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Would you set the scene for our conversation, describe where you're living, where you're calling from now?
So I'm in Toledo, Ohio, as you mentioned, an associate professor here at the University of Toledo. I'm actually in my campus office right now, which is pretty, has no windows, so it's pretty, I wouldn't say bleak, but bland. but yeah, no, Toledo's a great place, and that's where I've been living for the last, decade.
Oh, wow, okay. I would love to start off with a reading from your story. Would you read those first few paragraphs for us?
Sure. So, Three Omens of Federico de Montefeltro, Urbino, 1472. Ottaviano held the staff high and steady as Scipio tugged at the bunches of leaves fixed to its top. He remains content, Ottaviano asked the draft's keeper. He does, the keeper said. Twice since sunrise he's moved his bowels. Ottaviano watched Scipio chew. With his knobbly horns, his puzzled hide, and his great neck, he had clearly been made for a far different existence in his home beyond the Nile, a home for which even the library's grandest atlas possessed only the most rudimentary of maps. And yet, snatched from that home, confined to his pen, the animal betrayed neither alarm nor sorrow. Once Scipio finished off the leaves, Ottaviano gave the pole back to the keeper and, cutting through the stables, returned to the palace. It was near the end of July. 3 weeks had passed since Battista had died, weeks which Ottaviano had been acting as count while his brother Federico mourned the loss of his cherished second wife. No part of ruling was in Ottaviano's nature. He loathed the public life, and now especially he would prefer to be in his turret room, readying himself for another ascent. Instead, he had to sit through his mornings, receiving petitioners, entertain the envoys who'd been arriving from all over Italy for Battista's funeral, and this afternoon visit an abbess to make, on Federico's behalf, the weekly inquiry into her nun's health. The sole half-hour whose loss Ottaviano didn't resent was his call on his six orphaned nieces, whose tears he attempted to dry with assurances of the bliss toward which their mother's soul was traveling, and on his nephew, poor, plump Guidobaldo, as yet innocent of all that was happening around him. Every minute was accounted for, and even as he walked along the hallway to a privy, craving the quiet it would offer, he was grabbed by an old man, one of the six who'd been attached to Battista's household, and who now pleaded for some guarantee as to his future. Only after Ottaviano told him he would have a good word for him shortly, did the old man let him go. For a moment, a single moment in all the day, Ottaviano was free, but he took little comfort from this temporary freedom. Not after, last night, Federico had spoken of his three omens. A hope had been rekindled in Ottaviano, a hope the three omens might well threaten. These last weeks, despite having to attend to every care that was usually Federico's, Ottaviano had also, thanks to the grace of one of Providence's turns, focused on reviving his efforts to speak with his son, Bernardo. For 10 years, Bernardo's body had been lying in its tomb. At present, his soul was likely, Ottaviano knew, in one of the far uppermost spheres.
Thank you for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your story yet, would you describe what the piece is about, sort of summarize for us?
Sure. So it's set in 1472. I'd like to look back again to check that myself. And it's a moment in, how big to get here, a moment in sort of the life of Federico de Montefeltro's kind of low life in court after his wife has died. And basically he's kind of had this moment where he's been at the height of sort of fortune or whatever, if things have been going great for him. And there's this turn that's happened in his life and he's wondering, you know, does this mean that he needs to like do something? Is he being punished? So he's turned to his maybe brother, we might talk about that a bit later, Ottaviano, for help with, how should I interpret what might be these omens, and do I need to step away from ruling my city, my little principality? And Ottaviano, at the same time, who is sort of into the occult, has been trying to ascend through kind of, he's a hermetic, he's into, I cannot pronounce, I will boggle the pronunciation, Hermes Trismegistus' writings, Hermeticism, kind of a mysticism, and he's trying to reach his son who's died. And this requires intense concentration. And he's close to finding a way to do that, he thinks. But if he has to take over the estate, he can't. So his decision is, do I say, sure, I'll take over the estate and I'll decide that, yes, these omens are true and you're right, you should step aside, Federico, and I'll take over and give up basically reconnecting with my son? Or do I decide maybe that I'm going to interpret the omens this other way so that Federico stays on and I can keep doing what I want to do and kind of risk maybe causing havoc for Federico and the state and the line, the family, basically. I think that's essentially a way to encapsulate it. It's kind of, in some ways, it feels hard, even though it's not that long of a story, to sort of, that's the heart of the dilemma, at the heart of the story.
Yeah, no, that's exactly how I would summarize it. I'm just so curious, how did you come to write this story? Like, what inspired you to start work on it? How did it come together as a first draft?
Yeah, so that could take a lot. it started out, so I went to Rome, I guess it's about 10 years ago, to do research for something else. And then I was driving, I wanted to follow an old Roman road for a particular reason that doesn't really matter here. And I'd mapped out like, what is the highway that matches this road? And you had to kind of get, it was not on the like Italian freeways. You had to kind of keep staying on the like small state highways. And so I was driving north from Rome into, the Adriatic Sea. And again, for this sort of research purpose, and part of the path took you through Urbino, and I had, you know, I had my guidebook, and I had been vaguely familiar with Federico de Montefeltro. Just like somehow I had seen, I think it's just out there, like images of him. Like if you see an image, you're like, oh, I've probably seen that painting. There's like several paintings of him that are pretty well known, and there's his kind of famous studiolo. Anyway, somehow, I don't know if there's an art history class or history or whatever, textbook, something else. So I was like, I'm going to stop off here, take a look. So I got there about an hour before the palace shut down. So I got out, walked around Urbino, walked around the palace, and then just went back in my car and kept on. And then years go by, and I was finishing up working on something else, and I was just thinking, oh, what's next? What do I want to work on? And for some reason, that visit to Urbino, you know, that kind of randomly just sort of like started to pull on me, like, oh, I think there's something here. And so I just went and got, you know, looked back through the materials I had, like I had bought the little like guidebook or whatever for the museum. And just starting from there, and getting histories and other things, kind of started to zero in on like, okay, who is this person? What is there in his life? Is there something in here that might be a focal point for a story? And started kind of, as I read, finding myself to this moment. A lot of what's happening in the story is sort of based in like kind of historical fact. The omens bit is sort of invented, but the actual kind of occasion for the story and the things that have happened to Federico, the loss of his wife, the sack of Volterra, all the timing. There's even a moment where he was even writing to someone and talking about the fact that he's like, what has happened to my life? Like everything was great. He doesn't say it this way, but he's, everything was great and now it sucks. Right? Like what happened?
Right.
And it happened really quickly. Like it just completely turned. And so for me, that was kind of like a valuable like story moment. Like, oh, this is a moment where a person has undergone a great shock. Their life has completely reversed itself. That might be a way into thinking about, you know, various things.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, did you, it sounds like you have something to say about this. Did you make up Ottaviano, or is he a real historical character and you just sort of imagined his point of view?
No, so he is real. He is, what is tricky about him, and it was tricky to address in this story, is Federico's parentage is still like in dispute. Like who, so Ottaviano is either his brother or like they're either uncle and nephew, or something else. It's been a while, so I can't remember, but basically it's unsure because Federico is not born, even though he became like the ruler, he was not, legitimate child of the person who kind of made him his son. And there's all sorts of speculation about who were his real parents and what is Ottaviano's relationship to him. But Ottaviano is a character, now he's much less discussed than Federico, since Federico is this kind of very famous personage in this moment in history. There's stuff about him, Ottaviano, you have to kind of like find these little like footnotes or things about him and this, but the fact that he was into like alchemy and into mysticism is sort of a fact. He had his own tower, in the palace to do that. And he did take over the state from time to time. He did lose a son. I don't know if the circumstances were the same, but about this, I think it's the same age. I think it was recorded. I can't remember. It's been awesome that it was doing that research. So a lot of the pieces here, you know, minus I like had to invent the omens, but a lot of the kind of pieces in the context were actually real, or, you know, as far as I know, based on historical accounts.
Okay, so the logistics and the process of how Ottaviano attempts to ascend are really intriguing to me. It's sort of this like knowledge equals power situation where growing his knowledge about the order of the spiritual world helps him ascend further into these sort of spheres and eventually hopes to reach his son, like you said. So it sounds like while I was reading this, I was trying to decide if you had invented this all on your own or if this is like based on something that you researched, but it sounds like maybe that comes from something you did research.
Yeah, so I did check out books on hermeneutics and sort of, and again, it's easy to get lost there. So I was trying to figure out as someone who's not into mysticism, I was like, how does this work exactly? You know, what is he actually doing? What did they believe? And what's tricky here too, in some ways, is this moment sort of in history is when this text has been found by the Medici. The Medici have sent like monks out to go find books, which is a big moment for the Renaissance. And one of the books they find is this book by Hermes Trismegistus that purports to be this lost hidden knowledge from like ancient Egypt that was sitting in this Greek monastery untouched for hundreds of years. And then everyone's like trying to get someone to copy it for them because, I mean, the printing press has been just invented, but, you know, everything has to be hand copied for the most part still. And so I think that comes up in this story. I can't remember if I cut that part where he's like waiting for his copy. So I found books on the history of Hermeticism and that from based on what I could gather on the things that were like that were in that text itself that I was able to kind of find and accounts of it, I think that's sort of what they thought they were doing. How they were doing. I mean, I think that there's multiple interpretations to it. So I had to kind of figure out like, okay, I'm not going to necessarily be an expert on mysticism because that would take, I don't want to go down that road. That would take a lot. But they seem to be as much of an approximation that plausibly what someone in this moment, how they might interpret those teachings and apply them. So it's semi-invented, semi-researched, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the way it's handled because I feel like, what you just explained is so complicated that it could be, you know, a huge heft in the story, like a big part of the story, but it's all very matter of fact and sort of very succinctly explained. And he sits down to do it, and this is how he does it, and this is what he needs. And yeah, I think you handled it really well.
Oh, thanks.
I think my favorite thing about this story is sort of how it asks us to take very seriously these stakes that I think in our modern world we might see as sort of fantastical or unreal. You know, like if we don't believe in mysticism. So we have this sort of crucial decision you mentioned for Ottaviano about what to do concerning the omens, and he risks losing, you know, everything, either his family or this opportunity he thinks he has to speak to his son again. And those stakes are so high for him. But, you know, to me, the magic of a story is making us feel how important that is, even though it's like really far outside our own experience of reality. You know, like we might not think those things are important, but we feel it when Ottaviano does. Can you talk about that dynamic at all?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of challenges, I mean, I think for this story, I mean, for any story, and a lot of it's kind of what you mentioned before, is like how to convey what he's doing without it being like, here's tons of research and it's too complicated and it just like weighs the story completely down. But yeah, the issue of stakes, I mean, it's something that, you know, I think about a lot, especially in teaching writing as well, is that something I talk about is if as long as like the main character cares, then usually we'll care. So I think trying to find a way that even if we're not on, you know, and maybe some readers are going to be on board for the mysticism, and that's fine, completely fine with me. But if we're not on board with that, if we're kind of like, this is really kind of sort of abstract or abstruse or whatever, but if we feel how much it matters to Ottaviano, if it's real to him and he cares and those stakes are there, then hopefully that's what brings the reader in, because then we care. And so I kind of feel like that always matters, whether it's a story where things are completely realistic and patently believable. But if the main character doesn't seem to care, then we're gonna, like, not going to care, even if it's believable. So conversely, if it's something where it's like, no, this is like in the quote unquote real world and believable, as long as the main character really cares and we feel that, then at least the hope is always that then the reader will come in and also start to care too.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I'm just thinking, like, do you, when you're writing, you know, are you making decisions about how to explain it in a way that makes sure that we feel that he cares that much? I'm just thinking about how clearly the stakes are presented in the story, like that he has this very clear choice and there's no like wishy-washiness about like, what if the omens aren't true? It's sort of like he believes the omens are true and he still has to make this decision about whether or not to tell his brother he believes them.
Yeah, I mean, some of that's in the revision process too, I think, in that often I feel like, you know, there's a certain level of the revision where you're trying to clarify those stakes. Like, you know, I think early on, at least for me, I guess I didn't say you, it's not, I don't know how general it is, but it's sort of finding my way to the story. What is the heart of the story? What will these stakes be? And then with each process, kind of refining and or shaving down or I don't know, went to the eye doctor recently, you know, and it's always, they're always checking, you know, giving you the choices of what's the sharper image, right? Getting that sharper image of like, what is it? So I think there were versions of the story where some of that was kind of fuzzier. So I did try to keep a line through it where he was still like hoping that maybe the omens wouldn't be true and that maybe the ones as he kind of heard more that they might be like debatable. But then by the end, it's like, no, these he believes they're true. But I think in earlier versions, I may have had more doubt there or more wiggle room for him. But it became more like, no, I need to like he can't be let off the hook, right? If he's going to make the choice, he's going to make the choice and needs to feel like that choice. So some of that, I think there was a sense of it from the beginning, and some of it, you know, was as you refine the story, kind of like zeroing in on like, how do I make this sharp and distinct for him?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I also think, you know, again, with modern readers, like they will have doubts about whether omens are true or not. And so I feel like it's even more compelling to just see Ottaviano have zero doubts about whether they mean something or not, or whether they mean exactly what his brother thinks they mean. It does just sort of ratchet up those stakes again. Yeah. I think my second favorite thing about this story is Scipio, the giraffe that is kept at the court, who you mentioned when you read from the first part of the story. And Ottaviano visits him and comes to identify with his captivity. But there's also just something sort of fun about those scenes with the giraffe and almost kind of funny. You know, they talk about, you know, has he moved his bowels and that kind of thing. Can you talk about choosing to include the giraffe in this story?
Yeah, so that's another element that comes from the historical record, and that I was reading. There's a biography of Federico. Like the one really big English language biography of him was written in like the 1840s. And it's this big three volume thing, and it lists all this like stuff about his court. And one of the things in there is it says he had a camel leopard. And I'm like, what's a camel leopard? And a camel leopard is an old fashioned name for a giraffe. So I wanted to bring the giraffe in there. He had other animals too, because it's like the idea of like, I don't know. I was like trying to bring in as many, you know, it's hard. You kind of want to, sometimes it's hard. How many details can you stuff in, you know, of like the court, like a lot of the look, you know, the little details too about like, you know, paying the visit to the abbess or whatever. It's like, that's a thing that Federico did, you know, like apparently like according to this. So I was trying to like find all this stuff, or the old men who attended Batista. It's like, yeah, there were, that was part of her court. She had these old men that would hang out. I don't know what they did, but they were just there. And anyway, so for that reason, I wanted to kind of bring in the draft too, because like the idea of just, it's just one other place, I guess, for Ottaviano to go. And then just to get the sense of kind of what part of this court would be. And then, yeah, he kind of, once Scipio was there, kind of took on a life of his own, and it became one, a way for Ottaviano to kind of think about his predicament and kind of project onto Scipio. And then I kept thinking about and I can't remember, when I first learned that giraffes don't really make much of a noise, like they're kind of, I don't think they're like completely mute. I think they're pretty much, sorry, I should double check this again, but they don't like really like, they can't really think about it, but they don't really make noises. They're very quiet creatures. And I forget if they can't actually bleat or if they just don't. I forget what the deal is, but I remember that being a thing. So I remember thinking about the fact that he might project on, he came up with the idea that he's projecting onto him of like, hey, here's this other creature who's having to live this life that he's not made for, just I'm not made for ruling, but he's fine, you know. And then kind of realizing, oh wait, no, actually he can't complain, you know, like he's just here, and I've been kind of fooling myself and thinking that he's like actually happy. So it just became kind of like other partly Scipio another way to kind of draw out, give space for Ottaviano to kind of think through his dilemma, but then also just have this whole other element of the court that's like, yeah, that is kind of fun and has that kind of, yeah, as you mentioned, that humor to it. And it kind of gives an outlet to, otherwise it's, I felt like, I mean, there's always risk with the story. And I think there's risk with this story that it becomes too almost like locked down or suffocated or whatever. And so you needed some kind of something else. And that became useful for that reason too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, on a logistical level, I think about how when I write things, you know, sometimes you need time for your characters to like reflect and think about things. But obviously that, you know, runs the risk of being very boring or very interior. And I love just, you know, going to visit the giraffe and sort of having these thoughts. It feels really natural. But gives those moments like a little more, yeah, like a little more levity or interest. Yeah. So from my research before we talked, I understand that this type of story, something very historic, isn't at all unusual for you, but I do feel like it's at least sort of unusual for us at the Common. We don't see a lot of submissions set in historical times, or if we do, it's at least pieces set in the 20th century, you know. How did you start writing these types of historic stories? Like, what draws you to the past when you sit down to write?
Yeah, so, you know, part of it just goes way back. My father was a history teacher, so I had an early fascination with history that I kind of got from him and was always interested in, like, I don't know, history of far-flung places, too, and it's kind of all over the place. I majored in history as well as English in college, so I kind of indulged that interest there. So it's always there, but I never really thought about it once I kind of realized, oh, writing, that's what I want to do, that's what I need to do. I don't think I'd really thought about how history would play a role there. Until right about when I went to the MFA, and that's when I started reading writers like Jim Shepard or Stephen Milhauser come to mind. There's a lot of others. I mean, it's funny when you think about that. I'm all like, well, I'd already started read, you know, Toni Morrison, and she writes, you know, beloved historical fiction, right? I mean, once you start to look for it, you're like, no, it's all over the place. But that's when I started thinking about, especially in terms of short stories. I think those two writers especially, I was like, this is really interesting, this thing they're doing. You know, Angela Carter also, although her stuff isn't necessarily historical, but there's a kind of quasi-historicalness to some of her stories are kind of set in the, I guess, you know, set in the 19th century, roughly. I remember those being kind of early things, just being kind of blown away, like, wow, how do you even do this? Like, this is just, I don't, you know, it felt like an impossible thing to do. But then I guess it was really that first semester in graduate school that I was kind of thinking, like, I don't know how to do this. This seems impossible to me. But then I kind of thought, well, look, I'm here at this MFA program. The whole point of being here is to, like, stretch yourself, you know, try new things, you know, figure it out, right? And so that's when I started writing. Really one of the first stories, I guess, you know, I'm trying to think. There might have been some other ones, but I guess the first one that really started to take ended up being a title story of the story collection, Byzantium. The first version of it was like completely different. And I wrote it for my first workshop. It was the second story in that workshop, but the first workshop I was in grad school. And then left it alone for like a year or two and then completely rewrote it later. But that's when I started taking a stab at, like, what would it be like to write a story set, in that case, it's set in the 7th century? You know, like what do I need? What do I not need? And I didn't really figure that all out right away, right? It's been in each story, like this story that's in the Common took actually a lot of research. They don't all take quite as much, but yeah, so I just kind of got started going with that and then started asking a lot of questions, doing a lot more reading. Anytime someone would come through, you know, who wrote in that vein one way or the other, you know, I would ask them questions, or some of the people I worked with in grad school had done that as well. And it was interesting too, I mean, and this is going a little bit farther, but I remember thinking about, like, what do you need to write, you know, historical fiction? And I remember asking, like, Stephen Milhauser came to visit our program while I was there. And so I asked him, like, what do you do? And he was talking about, you know, researching, you know, what kind of street lamps were in Manhattan in like 1894, you know, like, it's really like detailed stuff. And then Edward P. Jones came through and I asked him, and he was like, well, you know, they had horses then. You know, like, for him, he was like, no, it's not about the research. And I'm like, and that to me was really instructive. And I actually use that story a lot to students when I talk about research, because they're both phenomenal writers and they both won the Pulitzer. They both, like, have done really tremendous, like, work in the historical vein. in like completely in some ways different approaches to the like really high level research to like, no, you don't really need that. And it, so I think there's not necessarily one right answer. This is kind of like not really the answer you're, not the question you're answering, but as I've been thinking about what I need and how I kind of developed it, I remember going from the, at the beginning, feeling so overwhelmed, like I don't know how you even begin to kind of getting to a point. And it's still a challenge story by story, what's needed. But kind of realizing there's not really one right answer to how to even do a story like that, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I love that idea. I did think of Jim Shepherd when I was rereading your story this morning. He's a friend of the common and we love him. and I love that, you know, that thing that he does of taking like very specific historical moments and just turning it just a little bit. And so it's totally unfamiliar. Yeah. I wrote a novel of historical fiction and now I'm working on something that's much more contemporary. And I have really found that I miss doing that kind of research. Those real historical events just felt like a frame I could sort of work within. And now I don't have any frame anymore.
Right.
So I'm wondering, like, do you approach stories the same, whether they're contemporary or historical, or is it like a totally different process?
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I think no matter the story, I feel like I'm always trying in the early stages to kind of like find what is the heart or find also what are the limits? Like, what is it? Where does the story begin? Where does the story end? Where is the tension? What is, you know, if there's a narrator telling the story, why are they telling the story? Can be often helpful thing to think about. And so in some ways that process is the same. The only difference if it's a contemporary story is there might be like less research, but in some ways I'm still looking for and trying to dig my way toward what is the shape of this thing, you know, and what will be the thing that kind of holds it together? What is the, like, either the great desire, the want that's powering the story and that creates that conflict? And again, I think often looking for limits, and I think kind of what you mentioned about historical events helps with that. Sometimes they give you the limits. They impose the, like, you know, in some ways that's what helped with, you know, this story is I was at first looking at all of Federico's life. And so I was looking for what is the moment where something sparked? What was the moment where things kind of felt maybe a little extra dangerous or something was happening that might throw him off, you know, that I guess that traditional thing you're looking for too, when, you know, you don't want the normal day, you want the day that's out of the ordinary, right? So this is the moment when, you know, he's had this great triumph and then this great loss, so things are thrown off for him. So when somebody's looking for that, no matter the time period, I guess, of the story is kind of crucial.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I also shouldn't make it sound like people don't do research for contemporary stories. There are lots of contemporary stories that would require research.
No, that's true. It's exactly true. Yeah, yeah.
I'm just feeling a little bit, at sea without that, the way that I wrote the first book. So I always love hearing about a writer's revision process, and you sort of mentioned it a little bit, but I wonder if you'd just tell us a little bit more about revising this piece, like how different it is from the first draft. Is it significantly shorter? I mean, did you do any work with, I think you worked with our editor in chief, Jen Acker, a little bit?
Yeah. So there was a little bit of work, after you guys took the story to kind of sharpen some things. But even before that moment, I mean, I'm trying to think how long. If I think about the process, I think maybe five. I mean, this story took a long time, at least for a story. I mean, I guess it's always hard to say because you hear some people talk about stories taking years, but then they mention that the years that story took was like putting the story away for a long time, then getting back to it. In this case, I feel like, if I remember correctly, it was about 4 to 6 months of writing on this story and working on it roughly every day, right? So that was a lot. And a lot of it was because there was so much I was trying to get into it and trying to figure out the sequence. So like sequencing, like, you know, and so, you know, every story you have to teach the reader how to read it and you have to teach the reader what matters. And you have to do that without the reader really figuring that out. I mean, without that feeling too burdensome to the reader. So it has to be very smooth, right? So that's always a challenge. And this story, it felt like an extra challenge because it's in such a distant place in time. And so a lot of the work in the revision was trying to figure out what matters and what doesn't matter. Like, what does the reader need to know and what do they not need to know? So what can I end up cutting? And then how do I sequence those little details in there? And how do I drop in things so, you know, so that there's a moment, I'm flipping back to look at it, where I refer to, you know, Ottaviano, you know, giving assurances to his nieces about oh, hey, you know, your mother's soul is ascending through the spheres, right? So that was also very deliberate because I was trying to, like, start to plant little hints so that later when we get more into the Hermeticism, we've already kind of gotten those clues. This, you know, either the reader has kind of looked at it and been like, oh, it's that's all about, or else they haven't. But then, like, later it's that. So, like, a lot of the revision is trying to figure out how to sequence that so it feels smooth and it's not super clunky. But then also trying to figure out, like, what even matters. And then, of course, all the sentence level stuff, too. Like, how does this make sure this actually sounds, like, decent and not, you know, like, horrible? I'm trying to think how many drafts. I mean, let's see. I mean, I could look at my computer really quickly. This would not take me very long. Because what I tend to do, my actual process to get to that, since you asked about that as well, is I write it all out, you know, just in a Word document. And then I print it out and I make my revisions like with a pen. And then I type up those notes and then do it all again until it's done. And often, especially those first revisions, I'm basically rewriting a story by hand. I'm usually cutting pretty much everything. It's usually lucky if 10% of the stuff remains. So it's a lot, and it's really kind of grueling work because I'm having to type up my own notes. Also, I have really terrible handwriting that sometimes I can't even read, so that creates problems. Although I've decided that that's kind of an opportunity, like, okay, that specific word there maybe doesn't matter. But I do find that kind of like writing it out and then kind of sort of feeding it back through myself as I type it up, it's sometimes helpful as I start to kind of internalize the story and think through how it works and think through what's needed and what's not needed. But let's see. The last draft. Okay, yeah. So the last number I have on here is 48. So that means about 48 drafts. That is on the lot. That's a lot for me. Not a lot more than usual. I feel like it's usually at least 15 to 20, but instances of doing that. But and usually toward the end, it's more like really small adjustments. But this one just took a lot because it was a lot to distill and a lot to figure out what needed to be in there and what didn't need to be in there. And also refining, we talked before about the stakes, trying to figure out like what is the heart of this story? Why would anybody care? You know, it can be. Yeah, I mean, it was difficult to try to figure out or think through the fact that, like, yeah, I mean, this is, excuse me, it was hard to figure out the right, because this is, you know, kind of abstract and so distant from the everyday reader's experience. So trying to figure out a way to make someone actually care about it did take, I think, a lot of the work was there, too.
Yeah, you know, when I reread this morning, I was surprised at how brief it was, because in my memory, it was quite a big story, like quite expansive. And I think that's kind of masterful that it feels like this huge world. And in my memory, it was so elaborate and nuanced and complex. But when I actually read it, it's only a couple of pages. And I think that's a great sign.
Oh, yeah. No, it's good to hear. Yeah. I've always tried to, I always hope that there's more being delivered than takes space on the page or something. I don't know how to phrase that.
Yeah. No, I think you achieved it. So you're an associate professor of English and creative writing at the University of Toledo. And I was just wondering if you might tell us a little bit about your approach to teaching creative writing or what you enjoy about that work. Just always like seems like such a Herculean task to me, this idea of sort of teaching creativity.
Yeah, it is hard. And hard to get your head around. I don't know if it's, sorry, I'm trying to think, is it hard? I don't know. I think when you think about writing all the time, in some ways it feels easy to have these conversations with students. But also at the same time, I guess I've been doing it for a while, so I think it now feels in some ways less daunting. But what you get at is there what is hard and what I think is scary is that question of like, you know, what can teaching do and what can't it do? And you know, and one of the things, and I try to get really meta with the students pretty often in the classroom and trying to say, here's why I'm talking about this and here's how this works, you know, like here's the reason behind this lesson or whatever. And I try to convey to them the fact that, like, you know, there are a lot of things that you can't, like learn, right? There is a way in which writing or any art form, you know, any artist is in some ways self-taught, right? And so, you know, you can't, like, it's unlike, say, I'll have to pick on accounting because I have accountants in my family, but, like, you could take an accounting class and you walk away from that class and you know how to do a thing and you can go out and do the thing, right? With writing, it's not that simple. Like, you know, we can talk about character and plot and all these things, but then for you to actually figure that out, you kind of have to go out and try it out again and again and again and again. So in that way, we can talk about principles in the classroom and how these things work, and there's things for you to chew on. But it doesn't mean that you're going to walk out the door and then be like, oh, now I can do it. You know, it's more like you didn't have to kind of use those to essentially teach yourself, right? Which I think seems critical, because otherwise you're just kind of copying what's been done versus kind of finding your own way, so that you are finding your way to that like more distinctive approach, even as you're maybe using these core principles that seem pretty common to all kinds of stories. And so I try to highlight that in the classroom. I try to mention to them, like, that's how this works, right? Don't necessarily expect that, like, if we talk about today about here's, you know, that a character's often, especially your main character, needs to want something. Like, wanting things is really important in a story. And, you know, if you look at stories, you might even know. And how that's a thing that seems so obvious, but really you kind of have to be told, but that's not, like, the end of it. Go out and, you know, take a look. As you read, think about how that works in the stories that you're reading. When someone wants something, how does that empower the story? You know, note how often in a story you'll actually see the word want, you know? It took me a long time to kind of figure that out, to realize that, no, this isn't like some hidden thing that writers try to hide. Often it's there, right there in the story, you know, so-and-so wanted this, but, you know, this, you know, like it's not, it can be pretty explicit. And so I guess I try to emphasize that sense that there's that trial and error that does go beyond the classroom, but that in the classroom itself we talk about, you know, those core principles. And then, of course, in workshop itself, we look at, you know, how is the story working? Where do we see some of that happening? And where do we not see it happening? And how might that help?
I was just going to ask you, because I'm curious, as a professor of English, do you teach text as well? Like, what are you teaching this semester?
So, yeah, no, I do teach. So, actually, so my background is I have an MFA, but I also have a PhD in literature. And my position here at Toledo, I'm actually like split between literature and creative writing. So, I mean, right now it's the summer, so I'm not teaching. But in the fall, I'll be teaching two creative writing classes, one sort of the intro creative writing and then one the fiction workshop. But then in the spring, I'll be teaching two literature classes, one on 20th and 21st century American fiction, and then one on American literary traditions, which is kind of not really a survey class, but kind of like a themed reading of American literature. But I haven't actually taught literature classes just because of certain staffing dynamics in our department. I have been teaching more literature than creative writing for my first years here, but the last few years it's been all creative writing, but now I'm getting back to teaching literature again.
Oh, interesting. So always our last question for guests is just a question about what you're working on now, like what's next from you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's always a question I'm kind of hesitant on. I'm one of those writers who really, really, really... I used to talk about in progress work, but yeah, I was working on a thing that I have gotten to a stopping point with. So we'll see how that goes. And then in some ways, I guess I feel like I can say stuff about another project. So this story, there are other stories that kind of link with this story that's in the common. So I'm interested in trying to pursue, like, keep writing more, but I'd hope that I could keep linking up more stories with this. It's always, that's kind of like a, I don't know if that's a thing that I will just, yeah. I'm kind of keeping that as sort of like a long-term, like, here and there sort of thing. And I'm not sure, like, when that will end. So I don't know. And I'm always anxious to like talk about like, oh, this story I plan to write, you know, 5 years from now. It's like, yeah, I don't know where I'll be there. So there are like two other stories, one that came out last summer and one that's coming out in the fall that kind of link up with this story that's out in the common. And then we'll see if more make an appearance.
That's so interesting. I love that this story has siblings out in the world. Well, this has been so great. Ben Stroud, thanks so much for joining us. So nice to talk with you about your story.
Oh, thanks. And thanks again for having me.
Listeners, you can read Ben's story and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.